Did I just hear an alarm start ringing? Did I see sirens go flying past? Though I don't know what tomorrow's bringing, I've got a singular impression things are moving too fast.
Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Kurt Deutsch about Chickaboom Records and the last 5 years movie. Please stay tuned.
I just expected it 10 years later. I've got a singular impression things are moving too fast. And you say, oh no, step on the brakes, do whatever it takes, but stop this train. Slow, slow, the light's turning red. But I say, no, no, whatever I do, I barrel on through and I don't complain. No matter what I try, I'm flying full speed ahead. I'm never worried to walk the wire. I won't do anything just half-assed. But with the stakes getting somewhat higher, I've got a singular impression that things are moving too fast.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, February 15th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Matt Tamanini. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His new one is The Great Parade. It's going to be released on April 7th and available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many of the places on the internet. Matt Tamanini is Broadway World's chief TV and film critic. He also writes across other Broadway World sites, including Broadway World Orlando, and serves as Broadway World's database manager. He received a BA in journalism and communications from The Ohio State University and has worked in sports, broadcasting, and media relations and journalism. With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Kurt Deutsch is here with us from Chickaboom Records, and Kurt, you're executive producer of the last 5 years movie, is that correct?
No, I produced the film and the soundtrack.
You produced the film and the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, with Chickaboom, you have Ghostlight Records and all the other wonderful cash recordings that Kurt has brought us over the years. So, Kurt, thanks for joining us on a Sunday morning.
Thank you. Coffee in hand.
Excellent. So, we're recording on Sunday the 15th, which is the day after the official release of the last 5 years movie. What's it been like for you?
Well, it's been kind of a whirlwind, actually. We had our premiere in New York on Monday night last week, and it was actually deja vu because it was at the Minette. We retrofitted the Minetta Lane Theater down in the Village with a movie screen, and it was the same theater where the original Last 5 years premiered in 2002, and so it was a really amazing experience. And then I hopped a plane the next day, and we went to L.A. and had a premiere at the Arclight Theater, which is just a beautiful theater in Los Angeles, and red carpet and the whole L.A. thing. Anna was there, Anna Kendrick. And actually, that theater, I always want to remember the sound in that theater. It was a big theater with a 5.1 mix, and it just sounded the best that it's ever sounded. And then it's been out this weekend, and just found out that the distribution company is very happy with how it's going.
That's great.
So, yeah, it's in the top 10 on iTunes, and
it's great.
And I guess it's sold out last night in New York, all the performances. So it's exciting. It's very, very exciting.
It's hard to get a handle on what it's what kind of impact it's having beyond the theatrical crowds, because on social media, it seems as though that everybody's raving about it and very excited about it. But we're sort of an insular group because we're all connected to each other within the industry.
Yeah.
But I do suspect that it is getting anecdotal evidence that it is getting out to beyond the theater crowds, and it's getting very warm reception. So you, as years and years ago, as an actor on the other side of the lights, is this your first foray into producing film?
Yes. Yeah, it's I started out as an actor in theater, and then I moved to Los Angeles in 1991, and I did a lot of just really, really, really bad episodic television,
and some of which I saw.
Yeah, and so I mean, like, you know, like not good, and but the thing that was amazing about it was that I doing hour long episodic television is kind of like making an independent film every week, and you know, you're shooting 8 to 10 pages a day, and I did so much of it that, you know, it kind of stuck with me. And then and then we moved back to New York in 98, and I started this record label with Sherry, and then for the past 15 years I've been producing, you know, music. And so by doing this film, it you know, I'd always wanted to do this. I always felt like the last 5 years would be a better film than a theater piece for whatever reason. It was always in my head.
No, I think there's something to be said for that, partly because, and the opening number, when she is singing and talking about how it's all over, the next scene we see is them together in a flashback. And that's really significant because we know immediately that we are going back in time. It's very hard for an audience in the theater to know that the next song is actually his feelings of a different time and a different place. Mm-hmm. So I think the film is very successful in doing that.
That's great. Yeah, no, yeah, the we could talk about that. But I guess what I was getting at was the producing of music and the kind of making of the film was like this kind of interesting marriage of my two worlds. So as far as producing the film, that's kind of where I.
Well, it was great to see the Shikaboom logo at the top.
Wasn't that neat?
It was very exciting.
No, it was fun. It's kind of like the. Yeah, it's been, you know, it's really been a labor of love for me for a very long time. But getting back to like the theater, like the last 5 years in terms of it, I always felt like, you know, it's a very, very difficult show for an audience member who are coming in blind, because you're asking them to feel from the very, very beginning about something. And it's emotionally you're on a kind of a roller coaster. And so I think it's hard to. That's why the album has been so successful, because you can listen to it over and over again and just keep peeling away. It's like an onion. You just keep peeling away layer after layer after layer and understanding it so much better. And I think that when you're on stage and you're just seeing singers sing to the audience without necessarily the other person's reactions, it's becomes presentational and not as emotional. And I think that the film, the way that Richard LeGravenais shot it, and because he'd never seen the show, he only listened to the record, and so he had the whole thing in his head. He had no idea that they just sang to the audience. So he had this all in his head. So it adds this different kind of perspective, I think, for an audience member, and it allows you, you know, hopefully to feel for what the other character's journey and why they are. Why they are feeling what they're feeling, or why they're going through how the relationship has affected them. You know, so that's I think what I think, you know, they talk about opening up a film or doing mm-hmm. something, but I think that the idea is what it did was open up the feelings of the other person in a way, as opposed to kind of, you know what I mean?
So, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
it's so interesting. I mean, I remember that Kurt and I talked when at the time of the off-Broadway production, which was not, did not run very long. And the question of exactly whether it's even for stage productions, regardless of a film, how much, if at all, to bring the other characters into each number mm-hmm. sung by the other person. And I guess I've seen three or four stage productions now and now the film, and everyone has done it differently. But I did think that they did it very intelligently and very well in the film. I was so curious to see exactly how they were going to handle it. And they did. And of course, even something like being able to get in so close to mm-hmm. Anna Kendrick on the opening number, that helps tremendously.
Yeah.
And,
just something as little as having her sitting there with the photos in front of her on the piano, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It
the fireplace. It was a fireplace.
Whatever.
Yes.
Well, I wondered, Kurt, you know, everyone involved talked about wanting to keep it as true to the stage version as possible. But obviously, film is such a more realistic medium than the stage. What were the conversations like when everyone involved and Richard were trying to figure out how those moments that were, as you said, so presentational on stage would play out on film? Something maybe like Shmuel or something like that is a little different on stage than it is in the film.
Right. Well, Shmuel. Well, there's a few things. So in film, you have color that can represent time. You have clues throughout that you can put up. You have hair and costumes that represent. I mean, there's so many little clues that you're able to lay in there that you know, Kathy starts the film. Much more severe and a little bit grown up, less makeup, you know, and then as the film goes backwards, she becomes more youthful, and you see it in the color palette of the film. And Jamie starts, and the color palette is the same as Kathy's is from the beginning, and you see that go more severe as he gets older with his hair and the costumes, and they're more free and so if you look at it in that way, they were very, very – all the departments, all of the – you know, the art department from even Kathy's apartment to where the apartment started at the beginning to where it ended up at the end. It became colder at the end. Every department was in on that journey. And Shmuel was, you know, one of those interesting things because you've got this 7-and-change-minute song in the middle of the thing that is a story that – you know, that ultimately I think ends, I mean, it is such, it, you know, it's such a beautiful sentiment at the end, you know, of taking time and what you give, but you have this story. And so it was a challenge because, you know, on paper, it's just like, you know, that song is the song. It's Jason's favorite song in the show, number one. And he also says that's what the whole show is about. It's about time. It's about, you know, and so there was no way in hell we were going to ever cut it. And you know, we were like, Jason, but this could be your Academy Award song if you just make a new song. And he's like, no, I'm not writing a new song. Sorry, that rules the song. And so we, when that came off of the table, Richard was like, well, how am I going to do this? And then we met with animators. We were oh, maybe we'll animate this. Maybe he'll have written a children's story, you know. And I mean, there already is a children's book of it. And we'll have him give her a story and we'll see them come to life. But then we had this rehearsal when we did the pre-records of the band. We had 5 days of rehearsal when Anna and Jeremy came. I guess it was in April of 2013. And they came and they rehearsed. It was the DP and it was Richard and Jeremy and Anna in a rehearsal room for about 5 days. And they learned the music and they started playing. And what they ended up with in Shmuel was just – what you end up seeing on screen, which is just this, you know, this playing of the song. And it's something where Jamie gives, you know, Jamie gives Kathy this gift of a story, this gift of time, this gift. And they added this element of Kathy being, you know, she's a artsy, craftsy. She has all these hobbies. She's a photographer. She sews her own dresses. She does her own thing. So all of that lent itself to bringing all of her into the story. And then they did all these improvs, and you can see some of the improvs on the screen when she's interjecting, which I think adds life to the song. So I think that it just came from playing and just saying, you know what, this is the song. Let's just, what's the intention? let's do it, let's shoot it, and let's play. And that's what ends up, and their love shone through, I think, through. And now it's a lot of people's favorite song, which is kind of odd, but it's
beautiful. Yeah, it's beautiful.
What's really surprising to me, though, going back to 2002, I never thought this show would run only 2 months.
Well,
can you tell us what happened?
Well, there was this little thing called 9/11 that happened, and the show opened downtown at the Minetta Lane Theater in January, and it just couldn't find an audience. And the Times Review, you know, the Times has never been kind the last 5 years for whatever reason. Even in the revival, in 2002, you know, the Gray Lady was the one, was the paper. So, you know, it's been respectful, but it hasn't, you know, for the same reasons we've talked about, they just and didn't get it. And it wasn't until the album, you know, came out where people, you know, really started falling in love with it. And then regional theaters, thousands of productions have happened over the past 15 years. So,
yes, that's my question, really. And I have a feeling none of this would have happened without your record, right?
It was our first cast album, you know. And
was it really?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we'd made these, you know, James and I, you know, would commiserate a lot because, and, you know, I think you started your website maybe a little bit earlier than I started my company, but, you know, it was all around the time that, you know, Broadway.com started the same year you know, it was just all around this time where there was this influx of, okay, Rent happened and then the internet started happening. And then we were like, okay, well, Sherry and Adam Pascal are starring in Aida on Broadway. Maybe we can make their solo records and do kind of rock and roll and theater. And I think, Michael, that's Theater Mania was just starting, right?
Right
around the same time.
Yeah, that's when you came in. I remember.
Exactly. So we were all starting right around the same time. We had this idea to you know, that there's this new, we could reach a larger audience than just this 8-block radius of Broadway, you know? So anyway, we started around that time and cast albums were not really even part of my, you know, I had no idea. I just read some books and started making these solo records for a few years. And then as I was reading a little bit more, the last 5 years happened and it was no major label was going to do it. And I was like, how in the world can you not record this thing? Mm-hmm. It's just two people and five musicians. Let's just do it. And so I talked to the producers of Marty Bell and Ari Tepper. And I said, hey, I promise you that if we record this thing and we pay for it together, we will make money and it will be beautiful and people will, it's like a fine wine with age. It will just get better and better and better. And so we created a joint venture. We invested in the album together and it's probably the biggest off-Broadway album. I would say it's probably the biggest selling off-Broadway album since Little Shop of Horrors.
I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
So, yeah.
I have a few questions about the movie, and so I thought I'd take my opportunity, Kurt. If you first of all, I feel like I've walked by that building many times. Is that actually on 73rd Street?
No, it's on 119th Street.
119th Street?
Yeah, we were. It was in the middle of the summer. It was 95 degrees. It was a vacant townhouse. And it was on 119th Street and in like Lenox or something like that. Yeah, it was in Harlem.
I think there is one that looks very much like it in the West 70s.
That was the point. We wanted it to seem that way. Yes.
Yeah. Then a couple of other things. It seemed pretty clear to me, first of all, throughout, I think that the lip syncing, the dubbing, the whatever word you want, not dubbing, that's a different, was done extremely well. It seemed like
it was live.
Well, but not all of it, right?
About 90% of it was live.
Really? Are you really?
Yeah. The only thing that I'll tell you what was not live. moving too fast, couldn't be live except for little bits and pieces when they were in the apartment because it was cut all over the place.
Mm-hmm. And he's riding a bike.
He's riding a bike, and you know, it's all that kind of stuff. And he was on a boat, and you know, and all that stuff. So that couldn't be live. and in the car, I Can Do Better Than That could not be live. Yeah. Because you're in a car the whole time, so that wasn't live. But pretty much everything else, and bits of Summer in Ohio were in and out of live and not live. But those three songs were, and then there's little pieces of CM Smiling that were not live, you know, when she does voiceovers and stuff like that, and kind of little piece in Shiksa Goddess that wasn't live. But for the most part, all of those interior Shmuel was all live. I'm Still Hurting was live.
It was very obvious in certain places that it was really clearly live, like I Will Not Lose Because You Can't Win.
If I Didn't Believe in You was one take. That was literally all one shot. It was, you know, if you watch it, there's no cutting. They did it 17 times or something like that. That was take 12, I think, is what they say. And, you know, and it was, you know, yeah, it was just, that was all live one, you know, from the improv into the song. It was all live, you know. What Lawrence Manchester was our music supervising producer, and he was amazing. And we were able to have, we were able to cut back and forth between studio and live very seamlessly.
Very, very seamlessly.
Because we recorded the basic tracks in April with just when I say basic tracks, we recorded the rhythm section. So the piano, bass, drums, guitars were all recorded in April. So Jeremy and Anna had these little earwigs in their ears. It was different than Les Mis. I'll tell you how, but they all had their earwigs in their ears so they could hear the music, the playback of the music. And we always had a boom mic above them. They typically had a mic on their chest. And so we had two different, and then when we recorded their scratch vocals, we recorded it where there was a boom mic, a studio mic, and then another the mic that they would wear on their chest. So we were able to seamlessly cut back and forth, and it was really, really interesting to hear the difference between the three different kinds of mics, because like a song like Goodbye Until Tomorrow, where she's singing on the street, you had a mic over her, and it wasn't working for us for some reason. But then when we cut to the mic on her chest, it actually – you heard her heart, and you heard her breath, and it became this whole other – thing. And we're like, oh my God, where can we go find the other mics on the chest? And you know, it was just really interesting when you cut through these three different angles. It was very, very great. And then we would like have to dub in song like in Shmuel, and when you listen to the album, there's a lot more studio on the album than there is in the movie. Mm-hmm. Just because there's this whole sound design, and as a listening experience from an audio perspective, we wanted the album to sound, you know, to still retain the live feeling, but we didn't necessarily want to hear squeaks and scratches and, you know, like stuff that we were able to cover up with sound design in a film.
Sure. Well, I've always said that's one of the secrets, one of the basic secrets of a great movie musical is that it seems like they're really singing. That's true of The Sound of Music. Yep. It's true of the West Side Story, and it's definitely true of your movie.
Thank you.
And a couple other quick things I have to ask. Are we led to believe that Kathy's parents live on Staten Island?
New Jersey, dude. It was New Jersey.
All right. Well, they're going through Staten Island.
Oh, come on. But if you watch the
sign.
If you're in the car, there's a sign that says New Jersey. So you're meant to believe that she's from a little town in New Jersey.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, you do have to go through it, and I wasn't sure if they were going to take the Jersey exit, so I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's okay. That was the clue. It's Jersey.
Oh, and one quick thing. I thought it was so beautiful. It seemed to me that the only place – I mean, for the most part, the orchestration is – pretty much the original orchestration, wouldn't you say?
Well, yes and no. The original orchestration had no drums.
Okay.
So that's one big aspect to the difference. And it had one guitar, and there's two guitars, and there's no drums in the original. So we added drums, and we added an extra guitar for the rhythm section. But then we really sweetened. With strings.
Well, that place, yeah. I noticed that. The only place I consciously noticed a full, beautiful string section was in the transition, the turning point in Central Park.
Yeah.
When it panned up to the sky and then it panned down again. Yeah.
That was, I mean, obviously that's kind of naked and bare and you really hear that swell. I mean, Jason wanted 60 pieces, but of course he did. But yes, we had, I think, 15. But still, you're able to swell. And then he added that beautiful piano underneath it. So it does feel different. But there's... Throughout the entire show, we sweetened with extra strings. Movie. We sweetened with extra strings, and so you can really hear it. And if you really listen for it, there's significantly more orchestral stuff happening.
And I noticed that at the end, the cast list, a lot of people have been added as extras and little featured people, but it wasn't a complete cast list. For example, I noticed that Brad Oscar.
Brad and I did Summerstock together in New Hampshire when we were 18 years old. And we did Baby together and Candide together and some other shows and so I called him up one afternoon and I said, "Hey dude, you want to come?" And he just snuck in, and he was extra as extras you don't really credit extras. He kind of was like what do you call a glorified extra, so
Jeff.
He's just like that.
Well, Kurt, obviously getting a star like Anna to do the film is a huge boon for its success. But when you're talking about how much was sung live, obviously it took a special person not only to play Kathy, but also Jamie. So with roles that are so attached to Sherry and Norbert, what was the process like of trying to find an actor who could pull off these parts on screen and to be able to sing live? And what was the process like of getting – Jeremy and Anna on board?
Well, Anna, Richard LeGravenez is best friends with Todd Graff. And Todd, in fact, was the one who gave Richard the original soundtrack to listen to that he fell in love with.
Cast album.
The cast album. Did I say soundtrack? Oh my
you
god!
You did. Oh my god! Yeah.
Because this is the first time I actually get to say sound. I released a soundtrack.
Yes, but
anyway,
you did.
Anyway, the cast album, the original original off Broadway cast
That's
album.
Right.
Anyway, so blasphemous. Yeah. So Anna was in this movie that Todd directed called Camp.
Camp, right.
And she, when she was 12, and she was nominated for a Tony Award for High Society, right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So we were sitting around with Joe Mahoda, who is, now the CAA agent to the stars of all of Broadway. And he recommended.
Started as Sky in Mamma Mia.
Yes, he did. So Joe is like, "What about Anna Kendrick?" And this was before Pitch Perfect kind of hit. And Richard was like, "Oh, I love her. She was in Camp." And so we sent her the screenplay. And it turns out that Anna's favorite musical is Parade. It's her all-time favorite musical. And she had never heard the last 5 years. But she read the screenplay and fell in love with the screenplay. I think she might have even been going through a breakup at the time. So it really touched her. And she then listened to the album one time. She says she never listened to it again because she didn't want it to be colored. And she met with Richard. Richard fell in love with her. She met with Jason. She sang through a few things. Jason said, yeah, you can sing this. And she was on board. And she was she's perfect for the role. We all felt that we got very, very, very lucky with
what
her.
I think is great is, now, how long roughly has it been since this film wrapped?
We wrapped the summer of, you know, like
2013.
We wrapped filming, you know, like August of 13. Yeah. And then they edited for a long time. And yeah, so it's been, you know, we finished the film in January of 14.
Because what I think is great is that at the time that they were cast, neither Anna nor Jeremy could really be said to be big stars.
No.
But since then, they are really, you know, very deservedly.
Yeah, Anna has blown up. Blown up big time. And Jeremy, and casting of Jeremy was more challenging because that role, you know, that role's very challenging. And at that point, we brought in Bernie Telsey, who's a casting director.
Right.
We had already had Anna. And you know, we met with a lot of different guys. And we really felt that Jeremy, besides having just – Jeremy has this unbelievable talent to be able to – he can sing like incredibly, but he also – there's no difference between his singing and his talking. It's like there's no – there's right. just – it's just natural. It might as well just be – he might as well have just been talking, and he's just got this incredible voice. But what Jeremy had more than anybody else that we had met with was – he had both sides of Jamie. He had the sexy, I fall in love, I want to fall in love with you. He had the confidence. He had the, you know, but he also had the darker side of Jamie where you actually would believe that he would cheat on his wife. And you would believe that he has a darkness and an edge to him that that we didn't see in anybody else. And he also sang better than anybody that we met with. So we were just very, very fortunate.
It was an interesting decision in that regard to, I mean, I guess I just always assumed in the show that when he sings that song towards the end, that he is having an affair with one person.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. Maybe that's not necessarily true.
Well, it's Richard's interpretation. I mean, yeah. Richard's interpretation was that, when you are, when you're on the rise and especially in, you know, when he sings in, you know, the song, what is it? Moving Too Fast, not Moving Too Fast.
Nobody Needs
to. Miracle Would Happen, which is the song after the next 10 minutes that you see that he's tempted many times. And so he felt that it was more honest, especially when you're, partner is leaving town so much in the summer and you're left alone and you're going to all these parties with all of these, I mean, you listen, there's clues. If you listen to the soundtrack, you're going to these parties with your little girlfriends. She doesn't say girlfriend. She says girlfriends, you know, that he wasn't just with one person. He may have ended up with Elise or maybe not, but that he has had, these little rendezvous, affairs, whatever you want to call them, with multiple people. And I think in Nobody Needs to Know, artistically, he was able to kind of show that through that song that it wasn't just the one person, that he needs to be in love with someone. Maybe he's going to be in love with someone like her, Elise. I think so there. That's what I think his interpretation
was,
Kurt, for that.
You know, for the last 30 minutes or so, we've been talking about the last few days of your life.
Yeah.
But like beginning of last week, you won some sort of Grammy or something, I read online.
Yeah.
What was that all about?
Well, I mean, so Beautiful won the Grammy. And you know, my label put it out, and it's a great record. I think it's a great record. But we had a really good chance this year to win because I think I executive produced the Aladdin album, I produced the Gentleman's Guide album, and Beautiful. So So we had three out of the five. So if we didn't win, I would have been, you know, I would have actually, but I actually thought that Hedwig was going to win, honestly. Because but it was
a strong category this year.
Yeah, it was strong. And, you know, people like Neil Patrick Harris, as they should. And, you know, and so I thought, and Atlantic Records put it out, and we're just a little independent label, but I was very happy that Carole King's friends showed up, and there's a lot of songwriters, and, you know, it's all, you know what, we all just, the Grammys are great, the Tonys are great, but it's like, I've never actually been to the Grammys. I've won a few. I've never been. It's just because I feel like I just want to do the work, and, mm-hmm. you know, it's an honor. It's fantastic, but I just enjoy doing the work. And
how well did the vinyl 2LP version of Beautiful sell?
It's, you know, it sells to people who, you know, who it sold a few thousand, you know,
okay.
but, and it actually continues. The thing that's really fun is the Drowsy Chaperone vinyl.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
Sells because they do Drowsy Chaperone around the country, get these calls from the prop, the prop masters of these shows. And so, like, we hear you have a vinyl, and the man in chair needs to hold it up. So we sell them to all the prop masters around the country. And that was our first vinyl record we did. And then we did Hair, and actually we cut vinyl for the last 5 years, and we hope to put it out. We hope to put that out around Record Store Day in April.
I didn't know there was one for Hair.
Yeah, we did the Hair. So we did a Hair vinyl.
Let's get a little geeky for a second here.
Yes.
When you are going to plan to put something on vinyl, do you record it digitally and then convert it to analog, or do you have a second track of recording analog?
No, you remaster it for vinyl. Mastering is kind of the fine. Mix it. Mm-hmm. You mix the album, and then you master the album. Mastering is kind of the final process. It's kind of like, you know, the frosting on the cake is the way I like to describe it. It's when everything kind of balances out and sheens and shines. It's really great. So for vinyl, it goes through, I mean, at least my mastering engineer, he masters in analog only. So it's mastered in analog.
Okay.
But when it goes on to vinyl, it has to be remastered for vinyl because it can't be as loud and, or it'd be all distorted. So it's remastered, and then there's this. Actually, I think I posted on my Instagram the actual cutting of the grooves of the lathe,
oh, cool.
making the wax. It's a very interesting, cool process because you actually cut the wax, and you see it go through, and there's this little vacuum that picks up all the dust off of it, and you can look through the microscope and see all of the grooves. Talk about geeky. This is really geeky. But anyway, that's the deal with the vinyl cutting, and that's as far as I'll go.
That's cool.
We
didn't mention before that you had two other Grammy Awards for In the Heights and Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
And while Book of Mormon certainly has a tie-in, very strong community, Trey and Matt are very powerful people in Hollywood and in the industries. The In the Heights thing, I think that's a real huge feat to win a Grammy for In the Heights because it seems like such a outsider.
Yeah, well, I don't remember what it was up against that year, but In the Heights was one of those shows that became kind of a phenomenon that year, and it won the Tony. And I mean, Lynn is taking the mantelpiece. I mean, I can't wait to see. I'm seeing Hamilton on Monday night.
I was just going
to
mention Hamilton, yeah.
And it's, he is touched. You know, he's really taking musical theater to another level right now.
Is an album of that already set?
I don't know the answer to that.
So back in the day, back in the early 2000s, when I had my little recording thing and Kurt's company was just starting, we talked about putting together rock concerts of Pink Floyd's The Wall with Adam and Pascal and things like that. I mean, are you still looking at rock and roll type of different theatrical type of presentations?
Totally. I think that I always am a huge fan of the idea of concept albums. And I really believe in that. I mean, especially, you know, like the last 5 years, Jesus Christ Superstar, Evita, I guess, was a concept album, and The Wall and Tommy. I love the idea of starting projects that aren't necessarily bound by a medium. And if you let the artist and you say, hey, let's just make a record, let's make a concept album, let's do this, and without any aspirations for anything, it could just stay a record, or it could turn into a theater piece, or it could turn into a film, or it could turn into a concert. You know, I think that by giving an artist or a musician no rules and just go, their imaginations can kind of fly. It's kind of like writing a book. You know, you can just, there's really no rules in writing a book. So that idea, I hope I'm fortunate enough to be able to make that happen. 'Cause that's really my goal, is to kind of develop theatrical or film projects that start as musical pieces in that way.
So do you have anything that you can tell us that's coming up that you want to give us a quick preview on before you run for the day?
Oh, well, you know, my favorite record, I mean, the record that I just finished, Fortress of Solitude, is one of those shows, like, cool. Last 5 years that I think that when people hear that record are going to, are going to say, hey, what? That show did not succeed? It's Michael Friedman is, I think, an amazing composer, and is another one of those guys who is pushing the boundaries. And I think that the production, was challenged for a number of reasons, but I think that it will be rediscovered, as people hear that record. I'm really proud of the album. It's really beautiful. Not beautiful. It's really cool. It's really cool. And so I'm looking forward to putting that out in March. And then we'll see what the spring holds. There's a lot of new musicals coming up, and I'm really excited for Something Rotten and Hamilton. And I think those two shows, I've seen workshops of them, and I think they're both pretty they're totally opposite, but Something Rotten is really, really fun.
Well, Kurt, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning. We took up a lot more time than we anticipated of your time, and thanks for hanging in there with us.
No problem. My kid's playing basketball downstairs, so it's totally fine.
All right. We will remind everybody that you can check Kurt's projects out at shikaboom.com, shikboom.com, and we'll link to it in our show notes as well as some of the other fun things. I'll try to find that Instagram thing for cutting the vinyl. That sounds that's fun. I'll put that in the show notes as well. All right, Kurt, have a great day.
You too, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Was wrapped
Bye.
Up inside that one perfect kiss. Leave it at that. I'll watch you turn the corner and go. And goodbye until tomorrow. Goodbye until the next time you call. And I will be waiting. I will be waiting. Goodbye. Struggle to keep my balance. I open myself, one stitch at a time. Finally, yes, finally now, finally some.